The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining in. And thank you, Carla, for being here to talk. So let's just dive right in. I'm going to start with a simple question, Carla. How would you describe this book for those people in the audience who have not bought it yet? So guys, please buy it. The link is right there.
I would describe it as a book of reported essays, and as a very rock and roll.
Yeah, no, it's definitely in the interview I did with you for Gen Magazine, I called it an immigration punk manifesto because that's what it felt like very different to a lot of the literature around the undocumented community I've read so far. So I wanted to ask you, how was the process of reporting this essay, and what were some of the challenges you faced through it, you know, the time you were doing it?
Okay, so I can see the number of people logged in, and I mean, I'm sure some of them are bots that my partner paid for. I'm sure I'm going to upset people. And then the numbers are going to just go down. Okay, thanks for the extra bot, honey. So reporting on it was some places in the extensive media coverage this book has had, call me a journalist, and I'm not a journalist. I don't have the training for it. But what I did was, tried to adhere to a code of ethics that I felt respected the dignity of the people that I was reporting on. And I feel like journalists do that. And I feel like journalists of color in particular, you know, do that. I've read a lot of ethnographies, and I've studied and my dissertation for my PhD at Yale was under an anthropologist who worked with working class and rural communities. And so, you know, I tried to keep these things in mind. I was also thinking about my representational choices. So one of the things that I wanted to do in this book, one of the things I didn't want to do in this book was ask people why they came to America. Mm-hmm. Part of it was that I didn't have the curiosity myself. In terms of my parents' own migration story, I didn't have the curiosity of why they came to America. I felt like I've seen so much of their story here, and there was so much richness and complexity and Shakespearean drama in that itself that I knew that there was a lot of pain that, for reasons that I respected, I didn't need to know why they came here. And I also felt that American readers and white American readers and liberal white American readers had been so trained to expect a very juicy story of why migrants had made the journey. And there was a kind of an armchair evaluation of whether they had been worthy of being given the privilege of being allowed entry into this country. And so part of it was, you know, witnessing that certain people, like refugees, asylum seekers, were doing things the right way. And that's because they fled famine and war, and then some of us did things the wrong way, and that's because we wanted a better life, and that was bad. That was greedy, And so I just wanted to kind of train readers out of that by just yanking it out of their hands and starting the story in America. Mm-hmm. And so I just didn't ask. And in a couple of cases I did, and like in the case of one woman, I did ask because it came up naturally, and it was that she was escaping her children. She didn't want to be a mom. She didn't want to be a grandmother. And so she left her family. And that's not the story that you'd expect or that people would be sympathetic to, but that was her story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that another choice you made is that you don't really talk about dreamers in this book, like children, people who came here as children, like yourself, right? You came here when you were like 5 years old or so. Can you talk a little bit about that choice and why it was important to you just to focus on groups that typically do not receive the same media attention?
Well, as a writer, I felt like it would have been boring and unchallenging to write about dreamers, mm-hmm. because it would have been boring. Like, it's so easy to write about them.
And sympathize.
Write about us, you know, like, it would have been an uncomplicated structure for me, where it would have been easy to complicate. I would have been like, here's what you think you get. Mm-hmm. And here's what's behind the surface. You know, like it would have been easy to complicate that. And what I wanted to do was to challenge myself as a writer. Mm-hmm. And then obviously, like, the stories that we get are dreamer stories. Mm-hmm. Like, I never identified as a dreamer, partly because I was just like a contrarian little bitch who was like listening to Nirvana and being like, I'm not going to read any of the Harry Potter books. And then I was like, this word that was so saccharine, and mm-hmm. It had to do with an acronym and with the Dream Act. But like, one of my best friends from college is on DACA, and I was on DACA too. But there's nothing sentimental about it. It's just hard, man. And I think that like the discourse around dreamers is a little pinkwashed. And you know, I've been seeing stuff on social media about the graduations, and I think that there's a little bit of a fucked up messaging about how we owe our graduations to our parents. And I've talked to a lot of Latinx youth about this idea of gratitude. Mm-hmm. I think this notion of gratitude is something that immigrant youth across history, across national groups, across ethnicities have had in common. Mm-hmm. This idea of this gratitude that we owe our parents. Like, once you're just sitting at home being a child, trying to be a child, and your parents come home and they're tired and you see them be exploited and you're not really sure what's going on, and they tell you, I'm doing this all for you, like, you can't unhear that. And then you start to think that you can pay them back with your grades and with your conduct and with your posture and by being church going. And then it becomes paying them back in other, perhaps more toxic ways, like denying your own queer feelings, or denying the fact that you want to leave the church, or gratitude can become something, it can metastasize into something very toxic for us. And I don't think that's the right messaging for immigrant youth. I think graduation should be empowering. It should be, and I know that with the DACA decision being so close and seeming so scary, it's really easy to say, like, well, you made your parents proud at least. But I definitely think with it looming so large in the back, we have to think about the mental health of our youth, and to hammer home that you did this to pay your parents back, kind of like leader for leader in terms of, like, you know, their bloodshed for your grades is not the right messaging. And that's part of what I didn't want to perpetuate with my book. Mm-hmm. I'm like a perfect poster child for the American dream. And it's caused me so much emotional pain, and it's caused my family so much anguish. And I don't want to perpetuate that kind of messaging.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned mental health, and I feel like your portrayal of your own mental health, like, and the mental health of the people around you was so relatable and clear in a way that I don't think the Latinx community talks about mental health in the way that you were doing a lot of times. So why was it important for you to explore that part in the stories that you were telling?
I've become intimately acquainted with my own survivor's guilt over the past year, and it's been a long time coming. I remember my book is dedicated to the young woman who was shot in the head by Border Patrol when she was trying to cross.
Claudia.
And she wanted to be a nurse, and, you know, I felt personally responsible for her death, and that fucked me up for a while. And then I saw my father, who had, and this is, again, goes back to what I'm talking to you about messaging. And, mm-hmm. I have lived my life with a series of diagnoses and misdiagnoses. And what feels true to me is that I am struggling with complex trauma, and the diagnosis, which people within the community, a term they don't like, but it's the closest approximation, is borderline personality disorder, which a lot of people of color are diagnosed with, but is essentially like trauma from childhood and attachment issues. One of the things that in borderline personality disorder, one of the things that you have is you want to find a life worth living. That's the goal. You want to find a life worth living, because a lot of people are suicidal and, like, have been suicidal since they were very little. I was suicidal since I was 5 years old. And so I saw my father, and my father was the person who worked outside the home until recently. My mom stayed home, and my father worked for us, for me, until I was 10. And then my little brother, and he did the whole, like, going to work, coming home, going to church, just back and forth. And then, like, you know, just we would go to the park, he'd read a book, but it was just like work home. And he did it for his children. Like, he lived his life for his children. He'd say that to us all the time. You know, like, his feet would hurt, and he'd be like, I do this for you. Mm-hmm. And then his children grew up. Like, I graduated from Harvard, I went to Yale. My brother didn't do well. So I didn't do so well academically, but is a sweetheart, very good kid. And his kids got grown, And it turned out that, what was he living for? He was older, he was middle-aged. His father died and he wasn't able to go bury him. He had a lot of unprocessed trauma from his relationship with his parents who had been abusive to him, who were in Ecuador. And his body was a wreck. He had health issues. His relationship with my mother was in a really bad place. And he had nothing to live for other than his kids. I was out of the house. My brother had his own life. And that's what happens when you live your life for someone else. Mm-hmm. And I saw that, and it kind of coincided with me doing, you know, being, you know, I've always been fixated on this figure of my father as like this tragic figure. Mm-hmm. And as a tragic, like literary figure. And I was curious about, like, you know, I pursued that route into the kind of subjects I was interested in interviewing. So I like spent a lot of time with aging day laborers. Mm-hmm. And I saw that happen in a lot of their cases. A lot of them were aging. They were alone. They had left their wives. They had turned to alcohol. One of them was homeless. A couple of them were homeless. They were really good men. And it had been because this country had taken their dreams and chewed them up and spit them out. And they had come here when they were kids. They had come here. My dad came here when he was like 21 or something. Some of these guys had come here when they were like 19. Mm-hmm. But they were pursuing, it was like what a privilege to do what Dr. Linehan says, which is to pursue a life worth living. Like, and that is what I needed to pursue in order to keep from killing myself. And I noticed, and I tried to do this in my book, which is I had read that the suicide rates in the Asian immigrant community among the elderly were astronomical. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't do that work because so much of my work depends on the intimacy between me and my subjects, which is what a lot of people have commented on. And I was like, I can't do that work because I would need an interpreter and there's not that kind of access. And I was so startled by the mental health problems within the immigrant community. And so it became my focus. In a personal way, the first thing I did with my book advance was get mental health care for my family. I got therapy for my mom, my brother, my dad. My mom's on her very first antidepressant, and it's made a world of a difference.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I really loved about the book is that every character feels like a three-dimensional being. Like, they feel like people with dreams and that struggle, and they're funny, and then maybe their personalities can suck at times, and maybe they're kind of like hard asses. And I just wanted to ask you about that intimacy that you developed with a lot of like the people that you included in that book. Like, how was that process? What was some of like the challenges of, you know, getting really close and kind of like taking on a lot of like that emotional way of but they go through their life?
I think that what helped was that I really did approach them like I would approach my parents. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they talked my ear off and I would just listen and until I got a good story. And so I had a lot of patience. And I also knew I think what was kind of helpful is that so like when I sold the book, I sold it to very successful, very learned white publishers, but I had an elevator pitch. And it was a similar idea that I had for my dissertation at Yale, which was my prospectus, which I failed. But I sold it. I pitched it to like a room full of like professors at Yale, and I pitched them the same thing. I was like, you know, like I was introduced to the subjects or to one subject by like an activist or an organizer or director of an organization. But when I introduced myself to them, I was like, you know, I'd show up and like, my hair changes like a lot. I didn't have lightning bolts coming out of my eyes, but like I did have like green hair or like pink hair or like glitter tears or something. And they were just like, you know, like they were just like, who's this? Like, this kid looks like one of our kids, you know, like, and I would be like, look, I go to this school. It's like a really famous school. Cause you know, with our parents or grandparents, like we have to explain like what some things are. I did This American Life recently and like I had to explain it to my dad. I was like, there's this show, like, you know, in college I had this tote bag and it had this guy on it and it said Mrs. Ira Glass because it was a guy I wanted to marry, but he was very old. Like I'm on his show. Oh, so it's important. It's famous. I was like, yeah. And they're going to call you and ask you a lot of very invasive questions to fact check you. And he was like, oh, okay. But so I was like, okay, so like there's a school and it's called Yale and I'm a student there. So I'm a student. I'm an old student. But also I read a lot of books about immigration and I don't like them. And I don't like them because I don't see my parents in it. Like they make us sound like we love working really hard and that's all we're built for. Like we love working hard. We love working hard for very little money. And like, we're really happy to get any job we can get. And that we like have some weird connection to the land and the earth. And like, we really love being outside and like smelling the soil or something. And I'm undocumented and I want to write something better. And I'm a really good writer. And I promise to not use a tape recorder. So like they weren't intimidated. This was like right after Trump won.
Mm-hmm.
And I made this promise to my subjects that I will write in a way that's different than other people have written so that white people will care, which is not a promise I could guarantee that I could keep.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that I could do something radical so that white people wouldn't be like, like, that's so cute, or like, or like, I feel so blessed about my life after reading this book, or like, that's so sad that this happens, you know? I knew that it would make white people feel uncomfortable. I knew that it would make them think, and I knew I could do something weird with it. And I knew I could keep that promise. And so, and they shared a lot of problems that they had, a lot of mental health issues, a lot of pain, and I shared it back. Some of them were like, you know, one subject was like, I tried to throw myself into the train tracks. And there's a lot of stigma in our community about suicidal ideation. And I said, I've had similar thoughts. And when someone says that to you, you keep talking. Mm-hmm. And you form a relationship.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, in a lot of the scenes that you have in the book, obviously you change identifying details for everyone that you talk to. And a thing that really struck me and that we've talked about is that there were scenes that had this sense of like magical realism to them, that they were like really powerful and moving. I think a lot about in one of your first chapters, you kind of like reclaim the narrative around this day laborer that you name Waldo in the book. And you kind of like completely rewrite the way that he died during Hurricane Sandy in 2012 in a way that was like very powerful and beautiful. And I wanted to ask you, like, what are some writers and authors that influenced your decision to do that, or that kind of like inspire you to take this very Latinx approach to rewriting some of this stories?
That's a really good question. I like that question. Obviously, I've been super influenced by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know it's like uncool to say that now.
Isn't that?
It is. We're supposed to be like over magical realism, mm-hmm. Over like the Latin American magical realism. But man, I was really sad when he died. I never had a grandpa. Like, this is going to go into daddy issues. It's 27 minutes in. It's like, I was so sad. And I know he had, you know, some, if he was alive, he would have been Me Too'd. Like, I know that.
Yeah, definitely.
I know that. But he died at a good time. I just got lost in my thoughts there. But, you know, like, so I was inspired by his journalism. Mm-hmm. this is going to make me not be able to work for a newspaper. So his journalism would be like heightened realism. Mm-hmm. And I didn't do that in my book, in this draft. Like, he has a book called Notes on a Kidnapping.
Mm-hmm. It's my favorite book of his, actually.
And it's just the most effective form of journalism if you're not a journalist. If you don't call yourself a journalist, and if you're going to tell a story, this was the most effective way to tell it. There's narco-trafficking going on in Colombia. People have these stories, you know, people have the stories that you have the beheadings, you have, you know, the Escobar, you have the bombings, you have everything. Mm-hmm. People are desensitized to it. So what he does is he uses the tools of reportage, mm-hmm. which is what the new journalist did. Mm-hmm. Like, and then he tells a story. And it's like, it's super effective. It's not a thriller. It doesn't emotionally manipulate you. It allows you to feel empathy, which is I'm sorry for the genre heads, which is a higher art. and you know, he talks about this at length in his Paris Review interview, mm-hmm. where he just says, you know, like, I forgot what he says, but he talks about like just being a kid and trying to get his like reporting stories in like the daily newspaper and being like, I reported the facts, but I just, you know, I just made the story more colorful. Mm-hmm. It was just about color. And so my editor and I had like back and forths that were tearful, and I like threw myself into a swoon and had to be calmed down by cold compresses. I wanted to use a lot more magical realism in this book because I felt it was an homage to my tradition. And I felt mm-hmm. I believe magical realism is a belief system. I was raised mm-hmm. Catholic, and I used to look at the crucifix when I was a child, and I didn't believe in these stories, but I saw something when I looked at that crucifix. And then I was raised a Jehovah's Witness, and that's its own story. magical realism feels to me like an acknowledgement of suffering and collective pain and trauma when you live in a society where impunity is rampant, mm-hmm. and judges are corrupt and police is corrupt, and everyone who can do, like, who can engage in like human justice is corrupt, and the natural world acknowledges your suffering. And so that's why I wanted magical realism in the book. But I do so much good, solid reporting, mm-hmm. and I do some new reporting in the book. And stories about undocumented people are already not believed or taken seriously, that my editor was very smart, and he was like, people might not take your reporting seriously if you're experimenting with genre so much, it might not be the best idea. So I do experiment with genre, but what we did is we just were very careful about how I did it, so that it's very clear to the reader when I do it. And mm-hmm. I do it a select number of times mm-hmm. so that nobody's confused.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you too, you know, we are in the middle of this pandemic, which is why we're doing this through this format instead of like in real life. And in the book, you talk a lot about, you know, the lack of access to healthcare that the undocumented community has. And we've seen like this disproportionate amount of like people of color and people from marginalized communities, especially those that are undocumented and brown, just a few blocks away from me here in Queens. So I'm just curious, like, how have you coped with that notion? And like, what are some of your thoughts about, you know, the fact that the community is so exposed yet again to the worst parts of what happens in society?
I haven't coped well with it.
That's fair.
I'm writing a piece for Vogue right now mm-hmm. about survivor's guilt. And I am speaking with one of the leaders of ACT UP, which was a radical activist organization in the 80s and 90s that mobilized when there was total inaction on the government's mm-hmm. part around AIDS. Mm-hmm. and the AIDS epidemic. And he's an icon, and I haven't called him because I'm so scared to talk to him. I'm queer, and he's just a legend. And I'm scared to talk to him. I'm never starstruck. like I don't care if people are fucking people, you know, but he's someone who's he's done good, you know, he's a good person. And he's done good for our people, and he's put himself on the line. And I respect people like that. He's like, he's a real punk. And I want to talk to him about his experiences, because I've been going through a lot of that. Mm-hmm. My family's from Queens, you mm-hmm. know, I grew up in Queens. Elmhurst Hospital is my family's hospital. It's not the great care. It's subpar care, mm-hmm. but it's an immigrant hospital. And I remember when I was going, my dad had some prostate trouble, and I went to accompany him, and I had to accompany him to advocate for him. And sometimes mm-hmm. I would go wearing like, I had a singular Harvard hoodie, and I would go in my Harvard hoodie to make the doctors pay more attention to us, because they would spend like 10 seconds on him and be like, you have nothing. And they would care. They would be like, oh, you know, you got a smart kid. And there was this lady who gave me this little like card about staying strong or something. And people just if you looked like mestiza, or like if you looked like you spoke Spanish, they would like approach you and were just kind. And then there were African American people there who worked in reception or in security, who were just really pleasant to me and really sweet. And I saw news about some of their deaths, and they devastated me, because I was so scared to go into that hospital with my parents, because I knew that the care wasn't great. And we had some bad experiences there, but they just made it seem like somehow if they were there, like if the African-American receptionist and security guard smiled at me like maybe my parents wouldn't die. Mm-hmm. And I had OCD as a kid. So I just sort of made these like little, you know, sort of covenants with myself. Mm-hmm. And so I very likely had COVID late February, early March, and I survived, and it was miserable or whatever. And I just felt so guilty that I didn't die and that I was in Connecticut and that I live in a majority white neighborhood where it's like a grad student neighborhood. It's like nothing fancy, but it's green. Mm-hmm. Like my brother calls it the countryside. And I just felt like I should have died at Elmhurst Hospital. And every story that I read of somebody that died, I felt should have been me. And this has coincided with my book coming out and mm-hmm. getting attention. And I didn't get a lot of attention, but I got any attention. And I felt horrible. And people who are smart, culturally competent, therapists have been like, well, you know, obviously based on your story of migration and like the, you know, your life, there's like some PTSD. Survivor's guilt is a kind of PTSD, mm-hmm. and he was triggered by all of this. And I'll go into more detail in the Vogue piece, which I hope you all read, which will come out next week. But I did some unhealthy stuff after grappling with the survivor's guilt, which happens historically. It happened with Holocaust survivors. It happened with people who survived the AIDS epidemic. It happens in small ways with people who survive domestic violence. Mm-hmm. It happens in big ways with people who survive pandemics or genocides. And it's hard. And right now I'm just taking some time for myself. And I started hating writing because writing is what got me out mm-hmm. of the ghetto, you know, of Queens, of poverty. You know, I'm still not completely out. My green card's expired. Like I'm like middle class, but it's what made me special. And it just made me extremely guilty. And I think a lot of people, don't feel that way. I don't think Tom Hanks feels that way about surviving COVID. So it's just been an interesting experience for me. And if there are any young people on this event call, any young people of color, any queer people who feel similarly and have similarly experienced just a really rough time in similar ways that I've described, I'd just like to recommend a book that's been really healing for me, which just came out and is a memoir. It's called Building a Life Worth Living by Marsha Linehan. And she's a clinician and a scientist who developed DBT, which is dialectical behavioral therapy, which was developed for borderline personality disorder, which she herself has lived with her entire life. But it's also really useful for like OCD and eating disorders and emotional regulation, distress tolerance. And just reading the memoir of someone who has lived with a lot of demons and has, the way she describes it is she made a vow to herself when she was a teenager to get out of hell herself so she can help other people get out. I find really inspiring.
Mm-hmm. I have one last question and then we're gonna take questions from the public. I can see in the little chat, there's a few of them. I hate the term self-care because it just has some implications about, you know, money and who's privileged enough to do that and so on. But I wanted to ask you, like, throughout this period of reporting this book and then it coming out and whatnot, in which ways do you take care of yourself as, like, you know, a young Latinx woman who is queer and who's undocumented and lives in, like, the intersection of all these identities that do feel under attack very, very often?
Well, I'm like semi-documented. My green card's expired, so don't let's just not tell USCIS, which is going bankrupt. let's just hope they get to my green card and renew it with them before they go bankrupt, which is this summer. Self-care. Here's the problem, and I think all of you young people, people of color who grew up in poverty, and who've had a complicated relationship with social mobility might understand. People who grew up as gifted children might understand. Lena Dunham, that was a joke. The thing that you loved as a child that brought you peace and joy and helped you calm yourself when you were feeling scared, or helped you drown out the sound of your parents fighting, is what you probably learned to monetize, to make a career out of, and is what you probably learned to use to put food on the table for your family, and is probably what got you out. So you probably kind of resent it a little bit. And so so sometimes therapists are like, why don't you write in a journal? And I'm like, I ain't writing unless it's for a publication. Mm-hmm. And so I can't write out my feelings. I can't write unless there's gonna be an audience. I can't write unless it's for publication. So I was like, okay, so I'm gonna color. I'm gonna listen to a podcast and I'm gonna color. But then I have to text all of these people and be like, I'm going to color for you. Pick which one you want. And I'm going to send it to you, but you have to guarantee that you're going to hang it up. So, like, didn't work. And then I was like, okay, I'm going to bead bracelets. Same thing. I was like, do you want a bracelet? What do you want it to say? What colors do you want? And you have to wear it. I can't get out of that mindset, mm-hmm. which is like, what I had as a child. And I have a psychiatrist who's great, but he only sees me for 15 minutes a month, but he's great. I think he really loves me. Again, the daddy issues thing. And he says, he was like, you need to love yourself. You need to learn to love yourself outside of your accomplishments. And he doesn't think I do. And so I don't know. I mean, what I do for, like, to soothe myself, because mm-hmm. my default state is like straight up hysterics, mm-hmm. is I put oils on my face. Like, I like these two oils, which I keep on my desk. Like, I like these two oils. This is the St. Jane, which is very luxurious. And this one's like half the price. I like aromatic natural oils that I put on my face. And this is like a very DBT thing, which is to like involve your five senses. Mm-hmm. And like they smell good and they feel good. And like, and it just involves my senses. And that brings me peace. I listen to music I listened to when I was in high school, because I think the last time that I was truly myself and I was happy was when I was in high school. And so I listened to like a lot of indie rock, and a lot of like Juanes, like Paulina Rubio, you know, like Selena.
Yes. So, I mean, they bang, so it's okay.
So, like, I listen to music that I listened to in my childhood when I was in high school, and it brings me back a little bit. So I regress to childhood, and I play with my dog. Lately, I've been doing these short nature videos, But again, that's for an audience. Mm-hmm. I just really need to learn to not be a child star.
Well, we're going to take some questions now. I'm going to open the little box. Oh, there's someone who's not a bot in here. Thank you.
I told you my partner bot from the bots.
Okay. Someone wants you to repeat the title and the author of the book that you were recommending just now.
It's called Building a Life Worth Living, and it's by Marsha Linehan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is a good one. It says, in your book, you mentioned that you once drank the social mobility Kool-Aid from college prep programs. How has your opinion about social mobility changed over time, and what has influenced it?
It hasn't changed.
Could you explain a little bit about that?
Well, now I believe college isn't for everyone, because my younger brother has taught me that through his grades and consistent academic performance since he was in kindergarten, despite a lot of both positive and negative reinforcement, bribes, and punishment. So I don't know. I feel like college isn't for everyone. No, I don't know. Like, don't talk to me about that. Like, don't talk to me. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, talk to someone who actually believes that college isn't for everyone. I still think everyone should go to college, because, like, that's my knee-jerk reaction. Like, I grew up in that era. I'm scared if a child of color doesn't go to college. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they'll end up dead. Like, I'm not that woke. I got married with a Hillary Clinton button on my dress. I'm not that woke. Like, if I had a child and I didn't drown it, I would force it to go to college. But I also believe that college is not for everyone, because my brother taught me that. And I raised him, you know? So that's why in the Flint chapter, that was a really hard chapter for me. I was like, no, but come on, can I please help you write a college entrance essay? And they were like, nope. And what can I do? Like, I don't know. But I found this kid who grew up in a very rural area, and he's white, and total poverty, similar elements of my story. And he just gets like really dark and depressed if he sees a person who's like not absolutely perfect at what they do. And he gets like really like suicidal. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's just like, I think we're not okay. I think we're not okay. So I don't have advice.
Let me ask the next questions. Okay, so says, your explanation of experimenting with genre is fascinating, especially the idea of what it means to blend journalism reporting with other kinds of storytelling that honor the lived experiences of your participants. If you have time, I would love to hear more about how you imagine this doing this in the future, in future work. I would love to hear more about how you imagine doing this in future work. May have even more license for creative experimentation.
I hope my editors in this class. We had a fight last night. Well, my next book is a YA novel, so I will have full license to to fictionalize, and I'm like really excited about that. My YA novel is called Dream Girl. And I'm actually really excited because I'm going to be working out a lot of, not just mine, but I think a lot of young Latina girls' issues with their dads, where we like, I don't want to generalize, but like where we kind of like hold our fathers on like a hero pedestal and they can do no wrong, and they, you know, their sacrifices are just like, they are just Jesus on a cross. And then our moms are kind of in the shadows doing everything. And we just don't really recognize that until we're women and older ourselves. And it really dictates how our relationships with men are. And this story is about like a teenage girl who's, you know, coming into her own queerness in New York City, more than loosely based on me, and my own relationship with my father, which if you've read my stuff, like, you know, is just really intense. And her father goes into sanctuary at a church. And like, that is just, talk about turning someone into a saint. You know, the whole movement is around him. And then she learns some details about her father's life that turned her world upside down. He was not the man she thought he was. And she sort of goes on this journey that at a much younger age than a lot of us go on, where she learns to see him as a person, and she learns to see her mom as a person. And this is like a coming of age story, and it's very New York. And it's a queer story, where queer doesn't necessarily mean gay. And it's a love story about a family. And I think that the only thing to do with a story like that is to experiment with genre. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not fucking around when I say that, like, rock and roll really influences my writing. And by rock and roll, I don't just mean like, you know, like just banging drums. I do also mean, you know, musicals and like rock operas, like Rent, and which was hugely important to me when I was coming of age. And drumming is really important to the cadence of my sentences, and I can't separate drumming from like the influences of Gertrude Stein and Eileen Miles in my writing. And when I read Finnegan's Wake when I was in high school, and I didn't understand it, and I still don't understand it, but it just like lit my body on fire. And I was like, that's how my brain feels. And when I'm like, just like kind of stream of consciousness writing, like I see Gertrude and Eileen in my writing, and I also feel Meg White in her drumming. And that's all rock and roll to me. And rock and roll in this generation of young people is hip hop. So like when I was writing, I was also listening to a lot of Kendrick Lamar, who was just absolutely a brilliant writer, and kind of narrates a lot of what I feel about social mobility. Who's like, he's like, if like I slip up, my family's going back to selling pot. Like, I can't slip up. So like, so I think this is going to be like a really interesting book, where I can do a lot of really cool experimentation with genre.
I'm so excited to read it when it comes out. Okay, so this one is a good one. Carla, what's the one question that you wish you had been asked and no one's brought up yet? I hope this doesn't come up as lazy. Seriously, fuck eyes.
Yeah, this is I just did this because people take a screenshot of this, post it on your Instagrams, tag me and tag One World, my imprint, so they can be peer pressured into retweeting it. Okay, that was my face for the pictures. The one question I want to be asked is hold on. I want to think about whether or not I want to actually answer this question. And I want to look at Talia, my partner. She's not sure whether or not she knows what I'm talking about. The question, I don't know. I guess the question, I'll be real. You know what? Because during a fight, so my partner and I had a fight, and this was a genuine fight about my performance during events, dignified events such as these. And my partner was like, you know, you just gotta chill out. And I just angrily said, you know what? I do not code switch. I'm real even on Oprah. And that was from Jenny from the Block, which just really inspired me when I was a kid. And I was like, one day I'll be real too, even on Oprah. But Oprah triggers me now because of the American Dirt stuff. But I would like to be asked, why do you think your book, which is an honest to God masterpiece, hasn't gotten the attention it deserves? this is going into a messianic territory that I did not anticipate. But nobody asked Beyonce that when Lemonade didn't win the Album of the Year Grammy. And that's because we all knew the answer. And it was like, well, wasn't it Taylor Swift's 1989 one or something?
I think it was Adele.
Was it Adele? Oh, it was Adele. Okay. Adele's fine. So I have a couple of theories. I've thought about this a lot. And you guys are probably like, okay, well, you just told us that you are a total psychopath whose tiny little feet have been running really, really fast on the social mobility track thing. And here's the thing. I think that I've been working so hard to promote my book, even though I absolutely hate attention on myself. I feel it's a disrespect to my community, because Latinx readers, DACA recipients, undocumented readers have been clamoring so loudly that this is the book that they've been waiting for. All over social media, all over their Instagrams, they've been writing these gorgeous short essays that I haven't asked them to write. I've stayed out of it. My publicist was like, you need to engage with people on Twitter. And I was like, I don't like Twitter. I've stayed out of it. And they've just written these gorgeous personal essays of their own that have been beautiful, and they should be writing their own stuff. And the media has ignored them. And part of it is COVID. Part of it is COVID, but part of it isn't. Part of it is that people dismiss it because they think it's a dreamer memoir. Part of it is the marketing, that because, you know, it says that I'm one of the first undocumented people to graduate from Harvard. But, you know, Eileen Miles blurbed my book, a literary icon, Louis Erdick reviewed my book, called it, you know, all sorts of things. And anyone who would read a page of my book sees that I'm a writer. But there is this prejudice against Latinx writing that dismisses us as being sociological and anthropological and taxidermied and dead, and sees our writing as an exhibit in the American Museum of Natural History. Sees us as an exhibit, like the bison. Here are these fucking dead taxidermied bison. And doesn't see us as capital L literature. My book has gotten one review, one, in the New York Times. And it was a great review. It was an exuberant review. But it should have been reviewed in a lot more places than that. It is a fucking masterpiece. And I'm not just saying that because I've worked for years on it and because I know it is, but because my community says this is the book that we have determined represents us. And there was just like an outpouring of articles written about American Dirt when the community said this was not the book and it should have ended there. And I find it so disrespectful that it has just been dismissed. And I find it horrific that during this pandemic, when Latinos are the number one group who are dying in New York City, and when we are the essential workers, and when we are being called heroes just so we can die, and that the right is just fighting so hard to reopen because they know that the people that are going to die are Black people and Latino people and Native people, that there is this dismissal of a book that narrates the story of what happened with the first responders after 9/11. It's an invisibility that is atrocious to me. And I think that as an artist, as an artist who's also like a performance artist, I'm just like, this is just kind of like, it's just like perfect. It's perfect that it would be bookended in this way, that I started writing it after Trump won, and that it would be published during a pandemic, and that a people that are called to be in the shadows when we are not in the shadows would be rendered invisible this way. But I would like to be asked, you know, everywhere, why do you think your book was swept under the rug like this? And I think it's because Latino art isn't respected. And Latino art from the days of Carmen Miranda has been just seen as a fucking pineapple in the centerpiece of a table. And there's kind of like no blurbs or no number of Latinx bookstagrammers that can get that to claim. And that's a fucking tragedy.
Well, I definitely agree that it's entirely unfair that not more people know about your book, but we don't have time for more questions. Thank you so much all for joining. Please support Carla's book. It's actually incredible. I'm not just saying that because I just interviewed her. It made me laugh. It made me cry. And it honestly made the undocumented community visible in a way that not a lot of people have made. It's extremely powerful. And you can get it, again, in the little link down there. So, yeah, thank you so much, everyone. I think we are going to wrap it up now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.